from the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the closing market report for the second day of July 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett. He's at agmarket.net out of Windsor, Illinois. Dan Zwicker is out of the office this afternoon. A bit later in the program, we'll check out the weather forecast and what things will look like for the holiday weekend and then going out into the second week of our forecast as well. Hot, warm, much warmer than average. Thanks, Mike Tenora from T-Storm Weather in Chicago. We'll hear all about that. And along the way, I'll let you drop in on a conversation that took place during a webinar this morning hosted by the Illinois Sustainable Agriculture Partnership. It involved both Cargill and PepsiCo. So stay with us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Here's the way the numbers in Chicago finish for the day. July corn at 342 and a half, down 5 3/4. December 353 and a half, 7 lower. And May futures down 6 1/4 at 370 3/4. July soybeans 1 1/4 lower at 892 and a half. November at 896 3/4, down 2 1/4. And January beans at 901 1/4, 2 1/4 lower. Bean oil futures down 25 cents at 27.90. The bean meal, 80 cents higher at 293.50 for the afternoon. Wheat futures on the dime. July soft red, 8 3/4 lower at 490, and the hard red at 427 1/4 in the July, down 15 1/4 cents. Live cattle futures, August contract at 99.40, up $2.10. Feeders at 134.87 and a half, $1.80 higher for the day, and lean hogs at $44.72 and a half, down 7 1/2 cents. We're now joined by Matt Bennett at agmarket.net. Hey, good afternoon to you, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you go back through some of the numbers that you thought were most important from the acreage and grain stocks figures and how those ended up playing out in the market this week and what your expectations might be going into the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, and so, you know, you came in Monday, of course, we had a fair amount of short covering with the corn market, you know, because we had a huge short. And I think a lot of the whispers were that, hey, this could be a little bit of a friendly report. You know, if you would have asked most traders, though, they wouldn't have suggested the friendliness of the report would have anything to do with acreage. It was going to have more to do with stocks. And so I will say that our group, you know, we had stocks pegged below 5 billion bushels, and we had acreage pegged at a shade under 95. So we were one of the lower guesses for acreage, but I'm not going to pat myself on the back too much here. We weren't even close to the 92 that they came out with. I think that was certainly a shocking number. So when you look at the report, yes, they added, you know, between 200 and 300 million bushels of old crop stocks versus what people thought we were going to see. And that's not friendly. We know that. I mean, so that part of the report was a little bit bearish. But you know what? You can take a good 800 million bushels out for that 5 million acre drop. And so, you know, there's no question that the grand total of the corn situation was certainly one with a very bullish tone. And so you saw a fair amount of short covering come in, and some people came in and wanted to buy corn. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. The bean report was essentially one that basically was a non-event. You know, the stocks report almost exactly what trade thought. Most people felt like bean acreage would be higher. If you would have told us last week corn acreage down 5, I think most people would have said bean acreage up 4. That's not what happened. We were up 300,000. And so I think that that was very supportive in that the acreage that was lost by corn was not picked up by soybeans. It keeps the soybean supply and demand balance sheet pretty tight.
So as you look at those corn numbers for the acreage, there was also some margin of error there, I suppose, that probably makes that 5 million lost really good, because they, in an unusual move, USDA, putting at the top of the report a note about additional acreage that had not been put in yet. The producers say they still were going to be planting that as of the middle of June. There were a couple of million acres there, too.
Right. And in the way that I read the report, I think the way it was to be read is that best case scenario, you plant 92 million acres because it included that 2.2 that had yet to be planted. And so you got to ask yourself, how many of those acres were planted? Certainly, going into June 16th, sentiment was not overly rosy when looking at the corn market. Supply and demand economics didn't look great. Profit margins on corn didn't look great. So did those 2 million acres get planted? I would say all 2 million acres probably did not get planted. And so you're probably going to end up 91, 91 and a half when it's all said and done. I also found it interesting that the harvested acreage percentage was a little lower than what they normally use. I believe about 1% lower than what they normally use. So about 84 million harvested. You know, that could go down another million acres or a half a million acres, which would be a pretty interesting deal when you plug it into your S&D sheet.
And now we have really a tale of two crops, old and new. Before, they were bound together just as a unconditionally large ending stocks number for both this year, current marketing year, and next year. Things have changed since the reports came out. How do you deal with old crop?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So old crop, previously, you know, what we'd seen the last 3 or 4 weeks is that basis had actually improved. And so with basis narrowing up a little bit, I think most felt like, you know, this stock situation might put the old crop in kind of a friendly situation relative to what we'd already seen. Now that you've got a few more stocks, I guess that's not necessarily the way that we should be looking at it. This corn is going to have to come to the market by all accounts. Now, whenever you start to plug in even a trend line yield, you know, with 84 million harvested, you're still looking at a 2.5 at the lowest, and that's being pretty aggressive on demand, more likely around a 2.7 carry. And so you're not exactly in a snug situation. And I feel like these cash bushels are kind of in a box at this point that they're going to struggle to get out of. You've got to hope for a major weather market at this stage of the game to get much more out of your corn than what you're currently going to see, because if you do rally the market, whatever you want to call it, 20, 30, 40 cents, you're going to hit a law of diminishing returns, as the basis is very likely to widen on any upward movement because there's plenty of cash to reward the market.
So on old crop, sell into the rally.
Yeah, I think on old crop, sell into a rally. On new crop, you've heard me say this before, but I don't consider a rally unless something's been sold. And I know that it's pretty tough to sell below crop insurance prices yet, but if I'm sitting in a situation where I feel really good about production, and in parts of central Illinois, I think there's producers that feel really good about production. If that's the case and I can get through pollination okay, maybe a little more of a pop in the market, I think as we rally, we at least have to be setting floors under this market, because anytime you're sitting 30 to 40 cents better than what you were the previous week, which is what we essentially saw on the high of the week, to me, to ignore that is probably not a real smart move.
And finally, a word on marketing soybeans.
You know, I think as far as soybeans are concerned, I'm a little more friendly overall, whether we're talking old crop or new crop. Yes, the old crop beans are going to have to move to market. There's no question. We're a long ways from having a soybean crop made. We did get it put in the ground early, but I don't look for any sort of major drop in the bean market until we know more about the crop. And so at this stage of the game, I guess I'm a little more patient on old crop sales and new crop sales.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Matt Bennett. He is with AgMarket.net. Well, earlier today, the Illinois Sustainable Ag Partnership, of which University of Illinois Extension is a member, hosted a webinar that included Jonathan Kappas, who's the director of the Gardner Ag Policy Program here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I, and part of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. He keynoted what was billed as a webinar on consumer demand for sustainably raised crops, like corn, soybeans, sugar cane, other crops around the planet. The other webinar panelists included Ryan Ciroli, who's the director of Global Row Crop Sustainability for Cargill, and Margaret Henry, who's the director of sustainable agriculture at PepsiCo, the maker of Pepsi and other products like Doritos from Frito-Lay. I pulled some of the discussion for you that includes Margaret Henry and Ryan Ciroli, as they laid out how their companies, Cargill, a procurement company from farmers, a grain elevator system, and of course PepsiCo, which is an end user, think about sustainability and what it means to them. Here's PepsiCo's Margaret Henry.
If farmers can't stay farming, then nothing else that we do as a company matters. So ensuring that the farming community is really strong, ensuring that we're investing in helping those farmers think towards the future is critical to us. Second, of course, it is our responsibility as a large global brand to address some of those big global issues like climate change. And so if we can work hand in hand with our supply chain on addressing those issues, that's something we're committed to. And so with public commitments around sustainability, around specifically greenhouse gases, around water, around livelihoods, these are things that we know are our responsibility, and we're trying to work to the third point of sort of how we approach it. We're trying to work in partnership with farmers, with suppliers like Cargill, with other companies. The last thing we want is for a farmer to hear one demand from PepsiCo, another demand from Kellogg's, another demand from Walmart. That's going to make everyone crazy. So the third point is also that we want to do this in partnership and listen to all the different voices from the farming communities, the commodity groups, the immediate buyers of products, competitors, NGOs, policy. We've got to work together to all be rowing in the same direction.
Again, that's Margaret Henry. She's the Director of Sustainable Agriculture at PepsiCo. As a follow-up, she was asked how her company is working with farmers in, for instance, the state of Illinois, through a program called Precision Conservation Management, or PCM. We've talked about that here on our program before.
Sure, yeah. We've been working with the Illinois Corn Growers and their Precision Conservation Management program for a couple of years now. And it's really been a fantastic partnership in what we try to do everywhere, which is find a local group that knows what they're doing, that's really credible, that's connected to the local, you know, in this case, the University of Illinois, which is fantastic, the local farming community, to IFAP. I mean, knowing who that group is that's really credible is critical, that shares our goals in keeping farmers farming and moving towards carbon sequestration in the case of this project. So the PCM was already an established program doing a great job of reaching out to farmers to help understand what they were doing and what some of the next steps were in that precision conservation management path. We decided to jump in and also contribute $10 an acre for farmers who wanted to try cover crops. And so PCM, the Precision Conservation Management Group, will go out to the farmers, engage with them about their practices, help show them, and I think this is really one of the strengths of PCM, the farm economics. For those farmers, what are the economics of different kinds of practices, all different kinds of tillage practices, all different kinds of cover croppy type practices, and then help those farmers to understand what's the next right step for them, offer that $10 an acre from PepsiCo, to try to help them get over that hump of a practice that costs some money up front. I mean, let's just be honest. It takes time and it takes some extra money to try something like cover crops. So we wanted to put our money on the line there to help de-risk that, help make it easier to start. What we're seeing is farmers can get started on a certain number of acres with some of that cost share money. And the vast majority are doing it on more acres than we cost share because they're seeing that return to their farm. They're seeing that benefit in the soil help them. And that's exactly our goal, is to help to spur the kind of change that we are hearing from the farming community and we are committed to as a company is going in the right direction.
Ryan Ciroli from Cargill was asked if his company was incentivizing farmers to use more sustainable practices as well.
I think from our Cargill lens, we're really looking at, for us to go where we want to go, right? Collectively, whether it's our customers, whether it's Cargill, whether it's, you know, broadly in the food supply, we really need to have farmer-centric approaches to what we do. So at the end of the day, are we addressing, you know, long-term farmer economics and resiliency? You know, are we looking at productivity? Or are we doing things that make sense for farmers? And so a lot of what we're looking at is really about how do we invest in soil health, right? So where are those opportunities to invest in kind of the adoption of soil health in the commodity space, and knowing that that's kind of a long-term investment, right? So we're not going to just look at something that's this year or next year, but really over a 3 or 5 year or longer term horizon, how do we, right, really invest in soil health to where we can really begin to see those there was returns that make sense for growers, right? So as we're driving, you know, increases in productivity with fewer inputs, you know, and able to kind of get that net return per acre where we want it, but at the same time also being able to create these reductions in GHGs, these reductions in, you know, improvements in water quality, and so the soil health is the basis. So for us to get there, you know, much like Margaret talked about, we're looking at, you know, partnering on programs or investing in programs that they may have a degree of cost share or some technical assistance to adopt things like cover crops. But we're also looking at a big support for ecosystem service markets and looking at, is that another way that we can bring a market-based approach that really incentivizes farmers, you know, for the ecosystem service benefits, the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, the improvements in water quality that they generate by investing in soil health. So in addition to getting paid for that commodity that they produce, the corn, the soy, the wheat, can they also get incentivized and rewarded for those ecosystem services that they benefit? And so I think there's a combination of things that we can look at, but at the end of the day, it's about farmer economics, willingness to adopt, and building systems that work to create kind of that mutual value along the supply chain.
If you'd like to hear more from Ryan Ciroli at Cargill or Margaret Henry at PepsiCo, you can do that by visiting ilsustainableag.org. That's the Illinois Sustainable Ag Partnership website. They'll post the webinar that took place this morning on the site soon. Well, on this Thursday, and just a quick reminder that it is the last trading day before the holiday weekend, we're joined by Mike Tenuri. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago. Hey, Mike, thanks for being with us.
Great being here, Todd, as always. I hope you have a great fourth coming up.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. And I know producers sometimes get worried about holiday weekends. The trade does as well, because things can change depending on what's happening in the weather forecast in particular across the Corn Belt. Why don't you tell me about this next week to begin with?
Well, this is one of the more challenging forecasts we've had in a while, and it's also one of the more important ones. It's been a long time since we've been sitting here and thinking about heat and dryness. And that is one of the scenarios that's on the table for the next 1 to 2 weeks. So let me start out by just kind of giving you an overview of where we are today. It's basically been raining quite a bit over the last 7 to 10 days. And that's wiped out a lot of the dryness story that was developing for corn and soybeans, and even more so for spring wheat. The Dakotas had a lot of rain earlier this week, and drought is no longer a concern across North Dakota, Montana, and the nearby areas of Canada. But for corn and soybeans, even though things have turned wetter over the last 7 to 10 days, we're now moving into the next weather pattern. A lot of the reasons that we saw rain over this period of time is because we're moving from a cool period into a warm period. We're now in that warm period, and you can certainly tell as you take a step outside. In fact, today was the sixth consecutive day of above normal temperatures on U.S. corn production. And the way it looks going forward, it's almost a sure bet that we're going to see temperatures be warmer than normal every single day through the end of next week. So 7, 8, 9, maybe even 10 days in a row of above normal temperatures. Now, warmth at this time of the year is not ideal for corn and soybeans because they like to develop in a cool environment. That's a stress-free environment, just like when you walk outside and it's hot and it doesn't feel very good. Well, corn and soybeans don't like it too much either, because they're trying to do all their different growth stages. And if it's real warm, it just makes it a little more challenging for them. So we know that it's going to be warm for about a week and maybe a little bit longer than that. There will be some storms around, especially in far northern and far southern areas. The wild card in this scenario always comes down to whether any of these thunderstorm clusters will sink southward and move into a more concentrated corn and soybean region. At this point, we think the northern 20% of corn and soybean production has a pretty good chance for rain over the next 7 days. As you head on to the south, sure, there will be some storms around, but at this point, it doesn't look like we'll see widespread and heavy rains. We'll get some clues about that over the next 2 to 3 days, which will then help us to formulate the forecast once we get into next week.
What does that second week look like, do you think?
Well, that's where things start to get a little murkier. Once you start to get that far into the future with some of the uncertainties that we already have, you just can't have a huge amount of confidence. But based on what we've been looking at over the last few days and even going back to last week, it looks to us like we're going to see a cool front move through sometime next weekend, so about 10 days out from now, centered on July 12 or so. The big uncertainty is that it's hard to say whether that's going to mark a pattern change toward cooler weather or if it's just going to be a cool front within a very warm and hot period. We tend to think that this is going to be a cool front within a very warm to hot period because the upper level high that's associated with the warmth that we have today is going to linger close enough to us that it's going to be difficult for that suddenly to disappear and then result in a cool weather pattern. If we're correct in this, then we're already looking at one of the warmer Julys on record because we only have to rank around 1.5 degrees warmer than normal across the 7-state region of the Corn Belt to have an unusually warm July. And at this point in time, with the magnitude of warmth over the next 7 to 10 days, unless we get a real big change later this month, we're going to be having to think a little bit more about that. So that is an important thing to monitor. That's about 10 days away from now. And again, we think that we'll turn a little bit cooler briefly, but maybe not move into a totally cool pattern similar to what we've seen over the last several years.
Warm is one thing. Hot is something entirely different. And hot and dry is completely different than both of those. Any indication on where you really think this is going to land?
Well, I think the problem in the near term are the nighttime temperatures. I know we've talked about this in the past, but sometimes in the past, it hasn't really been that big of a deal. Low temperatures around 65 degrees are pretty close to normal. We're talking about low temperatures in the 70s and even the mid-70s at times. And that's very far above normal, 5 to 10 degrees warmer than normal. Daytime temperatures will also be a little bit above normal, but closer to 90, maybe 92 or 93 degrees. One thing to keep in mind, Todd, is that a heat wave today, this period of time that we live in, is different than heat waves of the past. If you go back into the past, into the 1930s, and look at heat waves back then, high temperatures were very warm in the hundreds, you know, even 105, 106, 107 degrees. And then low temperatures would be in the 60s to around 70. So basically, we had a very wide range, but everything was shifted upward during the daytime. In recent years, in recent decades, a lot of our heat waves have been driven by warm nights. And that's what we're looking at here. Temperatures during the nighttime are not going to fall all that much by staying in the 70s. And in the day, you might look at the high temperature and say, well, 90 degrees, that's not that big of a deal. Even 91 or 92 is not going to be a problem. But when you combine that with a low temperature of 75 degrees, that's a different story. And we think that's what we're looking at here, at least over the next 7 to 10 days. A heat wave, but driven by warm nights more than warm daytimes.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it. You have a great weekend.
You too, Todd. Let's talk next week and see how this all worked out.
We will. Hey, thanks so much. That, of course, is Mike Tenura. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago, Illinois. Joined us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. Comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.